From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dagler. Linda Hogan is an internationally recognized public speaker and writer of poetry, fiction, and essays. Her main interests as both writer and scholar are environmental issues, indigenous spiritual traditions, and culture. Linda Hogan's most recent novel is People of the Whale. She is writer of the residence for the Chickasaw Nation and a member of the board of advisors for Orion Magazine, an environmental journal. Welcome to Writer's Talk, Linda
Hogan. Thank you.
Well, first we should thank The Ohio State University for having you in as part of the President and Provost Distinguished Speaker series, and people can learn more about that by following some of the links. But you're also here to talk as a writer, and I'd like to talk to you about your work, which deals often with issues of identity and with the conflict between indigenous and European-American identities. Tell me about drawing inspiration from your own life as both a member of the Chickasaw Nation and as a U.S. citizen. How does that, that seems like a very deep subject for you.
Well, I don't often think of myself as a U.S. citizen so much as the person from a sovereign nation, which is Chickasaw. And I think that like the people in the further north of us, the Iroquois, the Haudenosaunee, we should issue our own passports. So they do that. A lot of the nations are, you know, distinguishing themselves as nations by doing that. But I do think that, you know, those of us who are bicultural mostly identify with one or the other. Mm-hmm. And I work around people who many of the people that I work with in the Chickasaw Nation actually identify more as Americans than they do as American Indian people.
Okay.
And I always find that interesting, so I'm full of questions for them.
Well, what kinds of questions do you want to ask them as you're negotiating that identity?
I have so many in my list of questions. You know, how do you visualize God, for instance, is one of my questions. And, you know, how do you understand yourself, you know, as coming from our history? Mm-hmm. And what do you think of the fact that we once were mound builders, or that we journeyed, you know, up and down the Mississippi and met and made alliances with other tribal nations and mostly wanted to, or came from places where 30 groups of different languages of people could hang out together and communicate and pass on knowledge about astronomy, about plant lore, plant knowledge, medicinal plants, foods, you know, and traditions. I mean, that to me is an amazing thing. And then to come narrow down, funnel down into a kind of people with a smaller vision from what we came from, I don't comprehend. Mm-hmm. So I'm always curious about how we got so acculturated. Mm-hmm. And particularly those of us from the Southeast, because those of us from that region had the first contact with DeSoto early. And then from there came many other European nations, you know, the Spanish, the French, the British, and all their wars were fought out mm-hmm. in our land, in our part of the country. And you know, setting us against each other, even depending on who gave us weapons. You're sorry you asked this question.
No, I think it's really good. I mean, one of the things that you know, we want to do here is figure out, you know, how writers work, and I think a big part of that is background. You mm-hmm. know, and when you, like your most recent book, People of the Whale, features a character who comes from an indigenous culture, and then after a night of questionable behavior, signs up to go to be in Vietnam. And then
right.
it deals with sort of the aftermath of that, which seems to me to be...
You actually read it.
Well, I'm familiar.
I'm always surprised.
But that's because that says to me a lot about how do you identify? How does this person identify? And the character goes through maybe a couple of identifications that I don't want to give away any more of the plot, but there are questions about, you know, why does he identify with these? And there's a lot of struggle throughout that. And certainly, you know,
and people go through those struggles,
right.
And especially when they're younger, they go through an identity crisis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we go through this time where we question everything and question what we are. But the thing that remains is that we do come from this earth, and we need to maintain our relationship with the land and with the animals and with the plants in order to keep things whole and in balance. Mm-hmm. And that's really the basis of all my work, which is, you know, land-based, earth-based. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if I locate it in a different region than where I live or where I'm from, I go there, I learn the ecology, I learn the history, I study everything that I can learn about it.
Because mm-hmm. you have another book based in, I think, the Florida Everglades, with the killing of a sacred animal.
And, right.
I mean, did that entail then going to that area for a long time, or was that
yes,
something?
Yes, okay. I did research there, and okay. I stayed, it was the Florida Panther, and I stayed with Deb Jansen, who was the Florida Panther biologist in the Everglades,
okay.
and talked to her and spent time doing research. I read the court records on the case and read the environmental history, the ecology. Mm-hmm. I mean, because it's such an amazing ecosystem there, it changes within, if it elevates 2 inches, you have a new ecosystem.
Yeah, that's and probably quite different maybe from your Oklahoma background, which it seems to me like the ecosystems, for example, are much more stable. And it gives you sort of a different view on nature, I would assume. But not someone who's particularly good with nature. I'm not, no. I've
okay.
camped a few times, and that's about as close to nature as I get. You know? So tell me
so
more.
You're not one of those people who go outside at night and lay back and watch the stars to
I
see
have.
Where they're going to go.
Yeah, I have on occasion, but I'm often thinking, what's going to crawl on me next? And that may be more of the why I'm not as outdoors. But what led you to write the story about People of the Whale, your most recent novel? Tell me about the background on that.
Well, before that, I did a book with National Geographic called mm-hmm. Sightings, and it was about my friend Brenda and I followed the whales for years, and starting with San Ignacio and the Berthing Lagoons in Baja and going up to the Bering Sea area and gray whales, mm-hmm. not others. Although it actually, my interest started with a humpback in Hawaii when we were doing some other research and.
Sure.
So I was interested in the whales a long time before that. And then some elders from one of the reservations in that area invited us up to talk, to interview them, because they wanted to talk about what was happening over this proposal to hunt whales mm-hmm. in their tribal nation and how the tribe had made a deal with Japan to sell the meat for sushi, and there was a long story behind it. And it ended up just becoming a novel, which happens in my life all the time. When I did the one on the Florida Panther, it was going to be an article on a legal issue. Mm-hmm. And when it ended up being a novel, and the article never got written.
Oh, well, at least you hadn't contracted for the article, right? You weren't writing on spec for somebody.
Yes, okay. That's right. Otherwise, I would have had to do it.
Right. Important writer note here when you're going somewhere that you don't do that. Do you, tell me about being the first Chickasaw Nation's writer in residence, because I think that may be related to some of the stuff that you worked on in this novel, at least the ways that you want to work through some of the, as you had put it, the mythology, the history, and things like that. What are your sort of responsibilities as that?
That's what I'm doing now, is working on ours.
Okay.
But the governor had been trying to get me to come home, you know, for years, every time I saw him at a meeting or something.
This is the Oklahoma governor?
The governor of the tribe.
Of the
our
tribe.
Nation,
oh,
our
oh,
leader,
sorry.
Our chief.
Okay.
And finally he just said, what do I have to do to get you to come home? And I said, well, do you need a writer in residence? And he said yes, and he made a phone call, and he offered me a job, and okay. I moved there.
Okay.
And, you know, I actually miss my little old cabin that I had in Colorado with the creek running by it, and, mm-hmm. and listen to pit bull fights sometimes at night instead, and it's pretty horrible to live in rural Oklahoma sometimes. But
wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Sorry, Oklahomans. But it's the truth.
Well, this is the Ohio Channel, so we won't have to. What do you do for this one now that you have this position? What does your research entail? What does the work entail?
Well, I've done creative writing classes for elders. I've done creative writing classes in small rural areas. I'm putting together a program for a school for children that are sort of homeless children or children with, you know, special difficulties in school in other schools. And they're all Chickasaw children. And I teach classes. And I get some pretty incredible writers in them. And I also have written a performance piece, Loak Shapola, which was performed last year. And it was just incredible, not because I wrote it, but we also had a composer, a Chickasaw composer, Jared Tate, and my cousin, Margaret Roach Wheeler, who is an award-winning fabric artist, who did the costumes and the design, set design, and it just turned out to be incredible.
Okay.
And so I did that. I've done that, and I did a children's book, which is bilingual in Chickasaw and English. So
okay.
I do that for the nation, and I'm also doing a 3-year project in the Southeast on the mounds. And in fact, I'm heading to the Newark Mound in a couple
days. Oh, yeah, we just talked to somebody, one of the professors at OSU Newark, who does a lot of work with the mounds in Newark. When you are out doing the research, do you do, I'm curious about the specifics of it, whether you take a recorder along to talk to people when you're working with myth, with the history of it, or do you record it and then bring back your notes and do it? What's the writer's procedure for that you've worked out for working?
I take notes.
Just a lot of notes.
And then when I come back, I remember what I saw or, you know, whatever it is that I need to know, or I do research.
Okay.
And I also get a feel for the land. I'm interested in how it feels.
Tell me what you mean by how it feels like. The
energy of the earth, okay. What it looks like, what it might have been like in the past, what kind of trees were there before these particular trees are there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I went on a canoe trip down the Mississippi as part of my research. What a great job, huh?
Yeah, right.
Although it was quite cold. And,
what time of year did you go? Were you
March?
Okay.
Yeah. And, I mean, I kayaked with whales. I've been, ocean kayaking.
This doesn't sound like the usual idea of a writer, though, I have to say. You know, the kayaking with the whales, that's very unusual, I think, for a lot of writers who are more embedded in their chair.
I spend a lot of time in the chair, too, glued to it. Too much. It's bad for your back, though.
Okay.
It's much better to be out doing things. So I paddled down the river I had a guide, fortunately, or I would have been dead in the first half hour. But, I wanted to understand what the river was like because my ancestors, that was their highway. Mm-hmm. You know, that was how they traveled to exchange things and trade. Mm-hmm. So we had trades everywhere. And all the rivers go into the Mississippi, that then go down to the Gulf. So it was important to make that journey and realize how I would have been without the guide gone.
Mm-hmm. How long did the journey take you?
Oh, I only went for a few days. It was not enough.
It wasn't the entire journey then.
No, that would have been great.
Yeah.
But I would have tried to go when there weren't very many mosquitoes and when it wasn't that cold. So it probably would have been in October or something.
Yeah.
You're listening to Writers Talk from The Ohio State University with my guest, author Linda Hogan, a 2011 speaker for the Ohio State University President and Provost Diversity Lecture Series. More information can be found at www.writerstalk.org or www.facebook.com/writerstalk. Writers Talk is a co-production of the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University and The Ohio Channel. Now, back to my discussion with Linda Hogan and how she approaches writing.
So you've approached writing Chickasaw history, mythology, and life ways in several different ways. You've been a scholar, you've been a writer, you've been a recorder. How do these things shift perspectives for you, and how do you deal with it as, you know, creating the writing around it? Do you feel like there are certain things that you can work on and certain things you want other people to work on, or you prefer not to work on as a writer? When you've done so much identity work about what does this mean to be a person approaching it in situated in a particular way, when you're coming at this work, does it ever lead to a sense of fragmentation? Like, okay, I can talk about this as a scholar, but this aspect I can only talk about as a writer who is going to write, say, People of the Whale, that's going to be a sort of more historically or more of a mythology piece or more of a fiction piece? Does that
No, it takes its own shape for me. Okay. Whatever it is I'm working on takes its own shape. Okay. For instance, if I'm doing something on history, it may end up being more of a meditative essay instead of a historical document. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of those anyway, and I'm not a historian, but which is good because I hate to do things like make a little footnote and then follow it up, and you know.
Now wait a minute, you were a full professor, you know these.
I know, but I didn't have to do that. I was not that kind of full professor.
Okay, I was gonna say these are the lifeblood of if the students are watching at home.
And also, I don't call it identity work so much as cultural preservation. So you know, I'm more interested in conserving cultural history and values and traditions.
Okay. Do you find when you're doing that then that there are certain limitations in doing the cultural work that you're doing, that there are certain things that, I guess that this is maybe a rephrasing of the other question, that are too close to you to talk about? I know that you've written a memoir that was a very personal memoir and talked about the some of your family issues and things like that. Was that something that you thought I'm doing it for a particular like cultural preservation reason, or was it something that you wanted to work on as a representation for yourself? How did the memoir
work? You know,
it
took on really the history of the whole country by the time I was finished with it. It took on indigenous knowledge systems. My daughters, two daughters that I adopted, it took on the historical factors that led to their early lives and abandonment. And I took on why that happened. I mean, going back to them coming from the last massacre, the end of what we would call the American Wars and what the Americans would call the Indian Wars. So, you know, it was like that was the last takeover, and where everybody in the country, all the indigenous people, knew that they could not fight any longer. And so, you know, that history being so recent that my grandmother was alive at that time, you know, those kinds of things entered in. So it was a historical piece, but it was also about geology and minerals and water and, you know, just national history.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you talk about that with your daughters when you went to write it? Were they part of the sounding board for that piece? And they agreed with everything, or they were okay.
Yes. So that's always, I even talked about it with my ex-husband, and they made me cut things about him, and he was fine. He would have signed a contract, he said.
Oh. Okay. That's interesting, because a lot of people, when they're writing memoir, I think run into, you know, people saying, oh, that's not the way it is, or that's not the way
my sister was the one that was unhappy.
But, oh, really?
Yes.
And that's all you can say about that?
Yeah, she didn't. She just thought that we had an age difference between us, and we had different families. That's how it is, and it's how it is with brothers and sisters all the time, I've found.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's always a different version of the story that comes out. You've got a piece called Indios that is a long poem and a performance piece. Tell me about the background of that and how it became a performance piece as opposed to, you know, a different kind of writing. What led you into that, working with a composer and working with, you said, the fabric person? What was the background?
It's the story of Medea as an indigenous woman. And the first time I read Medea when I was a student, I realized this is the story of an indigenous woman. In the play by Shakespeare, her father is, it's not by Shakespeare. Sorry, I got my playwrights mixed up.
Oh, okay.
It goes further back. It's a Greek tragedy. Her father is a sorcerer from another land, and she's married to Jason, who's the golden man. Mm-hmm. And she helps him achieve things. And then he turns away from her and marries a woman from his own background. Mm-hmm. And in when I did research on this, I found that the Corinthians killed her children because they didn't want mixed blood children to come to power.
Mm-hmm, okay.
And so but she took the rap for it.
Yeah, I was going to say, she's usually the one that's taken as having killed her children to prevent Jason from...
Happiness. Yeah, because that was what he loved. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't the truth to the historical part of the story.
Okay.
And so I wrote it as a contemporary woman in prison for killing her children who says, is being interviewed, and she's the lone person on stage. There's no interviewer. She's just answering her questions. Mm-hmm. And it's a long poem, but it doesn't rhyme or anything. It's a performance piece. It just is written as a, you know, with line breaks. Mm-hmm. And actually, my publisher said it was the best thing I've ever written, but it was too short for him to publish as a book. It would never sell as a book. So he wanted to only publish a new and collected, you know.
Oh, okay.
Volume, and I wanted it to be a piece on its own.
Okay.
So I have another press that's going to do it.
All right. Well, that brings me to another question, because you've written in a number of different genres, essays, poems, memoir, novels, even documentary scripts. What's the one you feel most comfortable in? What's the one you like to return to? And that may or may not be the one you've written the most in.
Well, I think I love poetry the most. Mm-hmm. I always say it was my first language.
Okay. Why? I mean, if it's your first language, what makes you say that? Is it something just that as a child you felt the most conversant in? Or
what? No, I didn't write when I was a child. I only wrote when I was older. Mm-hmm. Because it says things you can't say with words, with ordinary language. Mm-hmm. And I love the way a poem works. It's like a fine weaving, you know, the way you put things together and then they become something other. They have resonances. Mm-hmm. The words resonate with the other words until some light comes out of it.
Okay. And that's when you know that you're done with a work, is when you feel that you're getting light out of it, as you said.
Well, anytime I see something I think is really beautiful and amazing, it gives off light. You know, like I saw one of Diego Rivera's paintings in a museum in San Antonio, and it actually was just luminous. I mean, it was beautiful, and I thought, that's why it's great art. You know, that's how you know something's good.
That's the definition then for you of art, is that it has this luminosity, this light when you see it, you recognize it, is that way? Okay. As a writer, what was the advice you received that you valued the most? What is, and my follow-up question is, what advice do you give that your students seem to have valued the most? Is there something that really stuck with you or that you always pass on to other people?
If it doesn't work, it just doesn't work yet. You just keep trying until you get it to work.
Okay. How long does that go on?
It can go on 10 years.
10 years. That must be sort of depressing to people in a class if they know that it's not working by the time that the paper is due or the story is due.
That's the trouble with class, with being a student. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to figure out but teachers don't expect students to have perfection, mm-hmm. I hope.
Mm-hmm. When did you get that advice? What stage in your career? Or is that something you just came to recognize on your own and nobody really told you that?
Actually, a woman told me that, but she was talking about something completely different than writing. Okay. And so, you know, it worked.
Okay.
And I think about that when I'm writing and something's not working. I think, well, it's just not working yet.
Okay. Do you set, well, as a writer, do you set yourself like goals for each day, or is it more of an organic thing? Like, it sounds like you sit down and you say, all right, this is sort of what I have to say and this is what I want to get done, but it's not like I need 10 pages today or I need 2 poems today or something.
No, nothing like that. If I did that, I couldn't write. I mean, I just sit down and it's organic, but I do have deadlines for projects. Mm-hmm. Like, I have 2 essays coming out in magazines and I had to have a deadline, and then it's like I hate it after you're finished and then they, you know, do the copy editing and then they say, well, we checked our records and historically this is incorrect. Could you please, you know, check your source? You know, we looked like, so I just had a thing, I have something coming out in Yes Magazine and they said, well, we looked in the back issues of Science News and we couldn't find this. And I thought, oh, you know, like I don't keep the copies of Science News and mm-hmm. how am I going to find it? So I went online researching back issues of Science News and I couldn't, then I thought, I asked my roommate, you know, I know we talked about this, wasn't it in Science News? And he said, no, I don't think it was Science News, you were reading something else. But, you know, it's like, I was telling a friend, I read like an anteater. I don't necessarily pick each one and note it, you know, mm-hmm. I'm just reading all the time.
Okay. So, that's a good line that we can use. Read like an anteater. Pull things up.
Eats ants. You just go, you know.
Words like ants on the page.
And then I assimilate information, but I don't always, that's why I'm not a historian.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that has to do with a cultural view, perhaps, that is less obsessed than European American or than Americans about citations, footnotes, getting it all in the background, because it's knowledge that you're aware of, but not maybe as worried about the source?
Oh, I wish I could say that, but a whole bunch of Indian historians would argue with me.
Okay.
Vine Deloria being one of them, probably.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, I just...
Well, he's gone now, but...
Okay.
You've, then he argued about everything. He lived in the next town over from me where I lived. And
so that was a writerly exchange or a cultural sort of exchange where you disagreed over the sort of cultural identities that you were discussing or the cultural work? Is that what you mean? Or just in general he?
No, we just had lunch together. But when I first met him, I thought he was the grumpiest person in the world. But he's the most revered person. I mean, as a writer, his work is just, you know, like I remember sitting with my cousin and a group of other people and my cousin just saying, old Vine's blown his top again. Have you seen his new book? You know.
Well, that's good advice then. We'll know to watch for people blowing their tops and then you responding to it. Well, Linda Hogan, thank you very much
for being here.
I really appreciate it. And your latest book is People of the Whale. Pick that up.
You've been listening to Writer's Talk from the Ohio State University's Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing. More information about my guest, Linda Hogan, and the Ohio State University President and Provost's Diversity Lecture Series can be found at www.writerstalk.org. or www.facebook.com/writerstalk. If you'd like to know more about social media like Facebook, surf to the website for the Digital Media in a Social World Conference, April 1st and 2nd at The Ohio State University. It's at www.dmsw.osu.edu. Following OSU President Gordon Gee's opening of the conference, past Wired and current Boing Boing editor Mark Frauenfelder will give the keynote and discuss how creating your own projects can be a meaningful, almost meditative experience. Then he'll give a workshop on how you can make your own guitar, like the one he played on the Colbert Report. We'll also have presentations and talks from dozens of OSU and regional people interested in social media, including Doral Chenoweth, the producer behind the Ted Williams Golden Voice viral video, and the OSU students behind the Ohio Union Don't Stop Believing video. If you're thinking about getting into social media, this is the conference to do it. Join me next week for Mark Frauenfelder and our discussion of his book, Made by Hand, Searching for Meaning in a Throwaway World. Until then, this is Doug Dangler. keep writing.